Back before seminary, I worked as the communications director for a large Episcopal parish. Part of my job was preparing the service bulletins every week. This parish had a teeny tiny problem with perfectionism. Mistakes were absolutely unacceptable. So they had a proofreader, a retired Belgian lady who came in on Thursday afternoons with a pencil case of red pencils, and she would go over the drafts before they were printed. The week that this gospel came up, which must have been 12 years ago, she marched up to my desk with a draft covered in furious red pencil. She had tried to edit the gospel text. She said, and I can't hope to get her Belgian accent right, so you'll have to imagine it. She said, "Hate your father and mother? Jesus cannot possibly have said something like this." So I pulled out a Bible and I showed her Luke's gospel, and she was shocked. She went away muttering. She could not picture the Prince of Peace, the Lord of Love, saying these hard and harsh words. Well, he did say them. He said words to that effect quite a lot, in fact. When I first sat down with these lessons, I thought, man, didn't I just preach about the cost of following Jesus a couple of weeks ago? And I did, 3 weeks back. In that passage, Jesus told the disciples that he had come to bring fire and division to the earth, that he had come to divide families against each other. It was not the first time the disciples, the men and women closest to Jesus, had heard this. According to Luke's gospel, twice so far, Jesus had told the disciples about the death he was going to die, and they understood they too might die for being associated with him. Jesus had also warned the disciples explicitly about carrying their own cross, that traveling with him was picking up the instrument of death. This was not new information to the disciples. They had heard it, and they chose to stay with Jesus. But according to Luke, it was the first time Jesus had been so blunt and forthcoming with the crowds, the hundreds or thousands of people who came to hear Jesus preach. Think this guy is charismatic and exciting? Like what he says about the kingdom of God? It's not all puppy dogs and rainbows. This is as real can be. Hating your family, even hating life, is what it takes to follow him. And following him will lead to the most painful, humiliating death you can imagine. Somewhere, the marketing folks are wincing. This is not exactly a surefire strategy for growth of a movement. We have to wonder how many people in that crowd simply turned around and went home for good. I'm guessing it was most of them. Jesus might be charismatic and exciting, but he was too shocking for them, too demanding. Probably when Jesus moved on to the next village, only a few of the crowd went with him. It was a lonely road they were choosing to travel. That huge crowd of people had dwindled to a faithful remnant. That might be a familiar experience for those of us who grew up in the days of churches bursting at the seams every Sunday. When I was a child, and probably when many of you were children, society expected everyone to have some sort of religious observance. In many communities, church was the only thing to do on a Sunday morning, so that's where people went. But for many, even most people in that era, churchgoing did not mean following Jesus and carrying the cross. It meant being part of the crowd, doing what everyone else was doing, whether they were committed or even interested or not. A sociological study published in 1955 found that an overwhelming majority of Americans believed in God, went to church or synagogue, prayed, and thought religion was of great importance. Yet when pressed, more than half of Americans admitted that their religious views had no impact on their political or business practices. The faith they proclaimed on Sunday had little impact on their Monday through Saturday lives. The study's author concluded that for these people, belief in God might well have been social convention. When society changed and Christianity developed a cost, even as little as having to wait a couple of hours for Sunday brunch, these churchgoers, like the crowd gathered to hear Jesus preach, decided to go home. The churchgoers who were willing to pay the cost are the ones who are here now. That's us. We worship in churches like this one that were built to hold the crowds. We wonder where everyone has gone, and we might feel as though we have failed. Why are there so many empty seats? What did we do wrong? But you know, throughout the Gospels, Jesus is remarkably uninterested in the size of his movement. The number of people following him, living according to his teaching, acknowledging him as the Son of God, doesn't seem to have concerned him at all. There's no record that Jesus even noticed the numbers. He never pretended that his way would be easy. He said over and over that it was not, and he seemed to expect that it would be too much for most people. What Jesus did care about was faithfulness to God, in himself and in the people around him. If being faithful to God meant that more people followed him, that was fine. And if being faithful meant that only a few followed him, that was fine too. Numbers were never Jesus' goal. Faithfulness was his goal. That doesn't let us off the hook for sharing the good news of God in Jesus Christ. We promised to do that in baptism, and Jesus clearly expected his followers to proclaim his message. It does mean that our reason for sharing the good news is different. We do it not to make our numbers look good, but to be faithful to God, regardless of the results. And we share the good news because other people are longing for the consolation and forgiveness and hope and purpose that Christian faith can bring. If they receive it, if they want to become followers of Jesus, that's fine. If it's too much for them, too demanding, too harsh, that's fine too. A quotation from Madeleine L'Engle's book, Walking on Water, came across my computer screen the other day. We draw people to Christ not by loudly discrediting what they believe, by telling them how wrong they are and how right we are, but by showing them a light that is so lovely that they want with all their hearts to know the source of it. I have baptized only one adult in my ministry. Lots of babies and young children, but only one adult. I'll call her Jennifer. She was not raised in a religious household, and she started coming to church because her fiancé, I'll call him Jason, wanted a Christian wedding. Jason was also raised nothing in particular. He became Episcopalian through campus ministry in college. He had a pretty tough childhood. His mother, who was alcoholic, abandoned their family, and Jason, like lots of children of alcoholics, carried some pretty deep scars. Yet he is one of the most optimistic, hopeful, and good-natured people I know. The hurt of his childhood never calcified into bitterness, and that was because of his Christian faith. Jennifer had a similar childhood. She saw that light shining through Jason's life and in the lives of a couple of other Christians she knew, and the loveliness of it drew her. She wanted to know the source of that light. So she agreed to go to church with Jason and to be married in the church, and when we finished their premarital counseling, she asked me to baptize her. Now, Jennifer is one person. Statistically speaking, it's not much. But has the light Jason showed her made a difference in her life? You bet it has. Yes, these words of Jesus are hard and harsh, but the light that pours forth from him is unbearably lovely. The harshness might be impossible for most, but for a few others, the light is life. They will want to know the source of the light. They will want to follow it, whatever sacrifices it demands of them. Our job as Christians is to show people the light of Jesus Christ. How they respond is up to them. We just keep showing them the light. Maybe we'll get some good numbers out of it, and maybe we won't. We can't worry about that. We focus on showing the light of Christ as faithfully as we possibly can. My Belgian proofreader wasn't much of a church person. She had been the parish bookkeeper when she retired, and as far as I know, she didn't really identify with Christianity at all. I wonder now if that's because all her life she had been surrounded by the crowd, by the people interested in the spectacle, but not by the disciples committed to carrying the cross and following Jesus. She'd also had a lot of pain and suffering in her life. And I wonder how things could have been different for her if she had encountered the light, the way Jennifer saw it in Jason. She's who I will be thinking of as I go out into the world today, and I hope you'll think of her too. I hope each of us will find that person in our lives.